There's a new list every day, it seems, ranking different cities and counties as happiest or most affordable, most conservative, whatever. These lists are about outliers, places where something out of the ordinary is happening. But a new list came out recently identifying the 25 most typical counties in America. And four of the counties on that list are right here. Jackson County, Clay County, Shawnee County, and Sedgwick County. That one's closer to Wichita, but still. Not only did those counties make the list, they rank pretty high on it. So today on KCUR Central Standard, we're asking what it means to be exceptionally typical. Because apparently, that's what we are. I'm Gina Kaufman, joined now by one of the researchers who put that list together. Patrick Ruffini is with us from Echelon Insights, a political polling and research firm in D.C. Hi, Patrick.
It's good to be here with you.
How do you define typical? Because it is so easy to hear that word as average or mediocre.
I like to think about it as these are places in the country that have it all. You know, they reflect the fullness of the American experience.
Go on.
And, you know, I mean, after the 2016 election, the genesis of this project, there was sort of this impetus among folks in the media in D.C. to try and go out into the country and actually listen, you know, people were so surprised by the results of the 2016 election that there was a sense like, maybe what did we miss? And usually that meant that, you know, they went out to small towns, tiny hamlets somewhere in West Virginia or in a place that Donald Trump did really well in. And we were looking at that and I'm like, well, is there a better way to actually define that? Because it doesn't seem like, I mean, you're going from one extreme to the other, it feels like, in a lot of these discussions. And so is there a way to define that, but also that isn't just in terms of the typical red and blue? You know, we have this sense in this country, we have extreme red places and we have extreme blue places, and we wanted to kind of find the perfect purple place, but not define it exclusively politically, because, you know, a lot of times there's a lot of demographic change happening in this country. And how do we sort of capture that, in a way and point the way to places that sort of reflect, the standard of where America is today, and not, you know, our notions of maybe where of 1950 small town America.
Or like following sort of trying to understand what you don't know by kind of having really extreme criteria for what even opens your eyes to a place to begin with.
Exactly. And so, you know, I think that there is value in going to places you don't know that represent sort of the complete diametric opposite of your sort of day-to-day experience. But, you know, I think, you know, from our perspective as a research firm, from the perspective of a lot of folks in the media, there might be some value in, you know, just going to places that sort of have everything, you know, a mix of all of these different trends. And, you know, obviously we didn't just look at politics here. We looked at education levels, income, age, things like that, to try to bring in all these different sorts of variables to try to control for, you know, maybe a county is really, really, you know, really ranks average in one category, but is off the charts different in another category. And there isn't one place in the United States that just ranks so perfectly in the middle on everything. You're usually a little bit different in one way or the other, but we're trying to minimize, you know, different that is.
Can I jump in and say that I'm sort of intrigued by the fact that the way to get like either, you know, media organizations or polling, you know, politicians who are interested in information about demographics, the way to catch our interest in something that is typical is to put it on a list with a superlative on it. So like, we can't just say that these are sort of these are some representative communities in this country. It's the most the 25 most typical. That's how it's a symptom of that same thing you're talking about, which is that our interest is really piqued by extremes.
It's quite possible, yes. I mean, and we just, you know, kind of flipped it around, then it's not just the extreme, you know, the extreme, but it's almost extreme average. But yeah, and I think we wanted to, there is data on all of these things. I mean, we deal with this every day. And so it's not hard. I mean, obviously, we all have our sort of subjective ideas and subjective judgments, but there is also the data. What does the data tell us? And, you know, the data can be analyzed to, you know, deliver an answer to that question. Maybe it's not the perfect answer. I mean, you could weight these different criteria differently and come up with a slightly different answer. Although we generally found that, you know, no matter how we did it, you know, the same kinds of places kind of came to the top.
Okay, so you looked at America and you gave counties a score that you called the Middle America score. Can you explain that?
Sure. So we combined everything from election results from 2016 to all sorts of demographics, race, income, education, age, all of religion, religious observance, any number of different factors. We weighted them, you know, a little bit differently. I mean, so we tried to include a very broad range of different criteria to really make sure we're capturing sort of, again, that fullness of experience. I mean, you know, we get that, you know, maybe a county can be, or a place can be, an outlier on one specific thing.
Can you give an example of that? Like a community that had a lot of what I will sloppily call averageness, but just like jumped out in some weird way?
I would say Jackson County, for example. So it's the place in America, and it's sort of
Jackson County, Missouri, where I am sitting right now.
That's right. And so one way that it is different is actually it's on the top 25 list. It's the bluest county on that top 25 list, actually, in terms of how it voted in the last election. Hillary Clinton won there, I think it was by about 17 points. Now you have Clay County, that's also Kansas City. That's a little bit more Republican. You know, it balances that out a little bit. So it wasn't, again, in exclusively like we're looking at any one thing. It's, you know, you can, you know, certainly have places that are very different, you know, demographically, and still be, for the most part, sort of be very similar to the national average on a lot of different fronts.
So in what way is Jackson County sort of typical as far as America goes, if not politically? Because that is something that interested me. Like around here, if you're looking at election results coming in from Missouri, the election results from Jackson County are among the last to come in. And so there's this sort of delaying in evaluating what you're seeing because Jackson County could change things a lot. You know what I mean?
That's right. I mean, it's one of the more Democratic counties in the state, in a state that's gone more Republican in recent elections. And, you know, what we just generally found on the main factors, I mean, other than sort of the political thing, which everybody, we're obviously interested in, everybody's kind of interested in it, you know, on just the rate at which people have a bachelor's degree is one measure. It ranks pretty close to the middle. You know, it's the county that ranks, it ranks very close on all of the different sort of ethnic and racial makeup of the county. And again, this is a little bit of, I feel like this is goes against the stereotypes because I think, you know, in sort of the DC, you know, media, New York beltway bubble kind of formulation of it. We need to go out to places that, voted very strongly for Donald Trump to understand what happened, that are primarily white places. And what we're saying is No, not necessarily. I think you need to go to a broad range. You don't need to go to just any one place, and you don't need to have a sort of rule of thumb, you know, that's this is the one and only battleground county. I mean, we provide, so this is the, that was sort of the motivation behind ranking sort of every county in America to provide this sort of objective measure. And, you know, maybe, and there's usually places all around the country that have this. But yeah, I mean, in terms of the more, some of the more social characteristics, leaving aside the politics, Jackson County and Clay County and, you know, the other counties you mentioned also just sort of, you know, kind of reflects the country as a whole more broadly.
When you say that it goes against a stereotype, can you say what the stereotype is? I mean, it sounds like that if we have sort of average bachelor's degree earning, but then we voted extremely blue, does that go against the stereotype of who votes how based on education or something like that?
You know, it's a little bit different in every place in the country, right? So I think that you have one of the it is one of the cities that, you know, Kansas City is one of the cities that is actually ranks pretty high on this list. So we found all sorts of communities are, you know, quote unquote typical, average, whatever you want to call it.
But we are. Very average.
You're number 8 in the country, and Clay County is number 13, and we have, you know, any number of others that are also on the list.
Yeah, Shawnee but County, Sedgwick County. We've got 4 of the top 25 in
that,
our two
in
states.
That area. And there's usually, and there's some, there's certain regions of the country sometimes that just do really well on this. So the number 1 and 2 counties in the entire analysis were in central Pennsylvania. So just to, so this is a great range of regional diversity in the counties on this list. There is urban and, you know, typically not rural, because rural is a little, I mean, you only have about 20% of America that's rural. So, you know, given, and the demographic characteristics there tend to be very different in ways that make them not, you know, the typical American county, right? The typical place you want to look at if you wanted to, if you want to go to one place to understand, you know, where things are going politically, socially, whatever. But it's usually a suburb. It's usually a small city. That is sort of the median American place right now.
You know, what's interesting to me about this is that we have this we kind of have this picture of ourselves right now, I feel like, where there is no in between, where there's only urban and rural, where there's only educated and uneducated, where there's only red and blue. You know what I mean? And so the idea that you're looking mm-hmm. for a place, are you finding places where within that county there is it's straddling a division, or do you find a sort of makeup of people where they're not dwelling in extremes? Do you know what I'm saying? Like,
Of course.
Is
yes.
there like, is it a divided county that's just a small version of those divisions? Or is it a unified little place where middle ground has been achieved unbeknownst to the media?
Well, I think that I think you get at a very important point, which is the fact that as individuals in this country, it seems like we are more polarized than ever before.
I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR Central Standard. And we've been talking with Patrick Ruffini of Echelon Insights about a list of the 25 most typical counties in America that his research firm and polling firm conducted and compiled. Kansas City's area counties have made that list 3 times, and then one near Wichita, Sedgwick County, that has also made the list. So 4 out of the 25 most typical counties in America by their measure are in Kansas and Missouri. Hi again, Patrick.
Hello.
So we were talking about a very poignant idea, which is, are these most typical counties small and divided as America appears on the face of it to be large and divided, or are they sort of middle ground?
As I was kind of saying, I do think that we have, there's no doubt that the people and people have very polarized opinions and have grown more and more polarized in their political beliefs over the years.
As
And
individuals.
as individuals, as people, right? And that's reflected in any number of even in election results, where counties and precincts and all sorts of different political units have grown further and further apart, there's no doubt that that is happening. But I would at least argue that we have a better shot, I think, at overcoming some of these divisions in places where those two, maybe those two polarized halves meet and live in a little bit closer proximity to one another. Now, that's easier said than done, for sure. But I certainly think that's the case.
So you traveled personally to some of these counties, is that right?
We did. I have been to some of these counties personally, I guess it kind of, now thinking about it, it kind of makes sense to me why this might be why it ranks highly. Used to live very close to, I think the number one or number two county on this list. But no, we
What county
actually.
is that?
I used to live in Pennsylvania, so Lehigh County was a place I was pretty familiar with, and it's sort of this old industrial Bethlehem Steel. It's known for Bethlehem Steel. And you look at the narrative of the last election, and in terms of why things turned out the way they did, the narrative being about the white working class, and why so many states in the Midwest, kind of went the way they did. And you can kind of see that narrative playing out in that place in particular, where you had this older sort of industrial place, but it's not a rural area. It's a city. I mean, it's a city that is sort of reinventing itself and is also increasingly diverse too.
So you have referenced that so much national perception comes through the lens of people living in Washington, D.C. or New York City, and because those cities are home to so much national media, they have a very disproportionate also like political like population of politicians, I guess. But how when you're looking at this measure of typicalness, how typical are those communities? Do the counties around those cities reflect America?
Not very well. So that's actually one of the not the, one of the most surprising findings. I mean, we find that DC proper is maybe more typical by our measure than 1% of America. Manhattan is more typical than 2% of America. Now, one of the things we find, though, is that there are places very close by to those population centers that do actually reflect, even within New York City, that do actually, actually seem to reflect politically, socially, more of the, characteristics of the country as a whole. So you don't have to go very far to actually experience whatever this, whatever it means to be, sort of a typical American county.
That is interesting because, yeah, like the spread on this list, it might be tempting to try and carve up the country into like, oh, well, the Midwest is like this or the South is like that, whereas the East Coast is some other way. But actually, this is a decent geographical spread when you look at
Right.
most quote unquote typical communities. You've got counties near Tacoma, Washington, Orlando, Florida, Albuquerque, Schenectady, New York, and yes, lots of Midwestern communities, but not exclusively, not even close.
And we called it the Middle America Project, and Middle America has this connotation of being Midwest, right? But actually, we find it's not. And you have, again, all sorts of different places. You have Phoenix, Arizona, that ranks pretty highly on the list. You've got all sorts of places also in the Northeast that also rank very highly on the list. But they're not, maybe not the major population centers, but they are places that are, thriving and close to some of the major population centers.
What are there characteristics that you can point out that sort of emerge again and again in these communities?
I think the thing you'd have to point out, the thing that they have in common is, again, you're not talking about a mega city, and you're not talking about a, you're not talking about an extremely rural community. You're typically talking about a larger, a larger suburban county, perhaps, or a city that's maybe not the biggest city, but still fairly large, that brings together, people from all different sorts of walks of life.
The thing, I mean, you've kind of gotten at this, but one thing that feels odd about this information, just from where I sit, literally where I sit in Jackson County, is that, we live in a metropolitan area with multiple counties that make up, where, when you're looking at elections and just when you're kind of like seeing license plates driving around your city. We're a multi-county metropolitan area. And some of those counties made this list of most typical places in America. Some counties didn't. And it's interesting to me that one of the most typical counties in America feels like one of the least typical in the metro, Jackson County, for example. Or that, like, Clay County, which is sitting right next to so many other Missouri counties that are within the Kansas City metro, that's typical, whereas another county isn't.
That does tend, we tend to see that a lot. And I think that we always tend to calibrate, I think, our sense of what's typical, normal to perhaps what's typical or normal for our state, or what's typical or normal for our region. And I think that, that may be true within the region. You'd say, well, the big city is not typically the most typical place. Actually, this is just, we're just trying to take a step back and look at the entire country as a whole. I mean,
So it's
I
like
think
that the weirdo in a weird family might be the most normal one there.
it's possible. Yes. I mean, you just look at this from the political standpoint, but you think Missouri has moved further and further and further to the right, it seems like, in national elections. And yet, yeah, you and as a result, you have the Kansas City metro area has also done the same things, but the places that might be a little bit more blue, so to speak, that may be more competitive at the national level, at the county level, even though the state is not that competitive at the national level, they tend to rank, as more typical in the context of the entire country.
So, I have two final questions for you, and these are related. The first question is, how are people outside of our counties likely to use this information? And then, how do you think people within communities that have typical counties, as we do, how do you think we could be using that information?
I think the main way I will say I think it's this seems to be very fascinating information to a lot of people. So I hope people will read will read and look up where their county ranks on this list. I think we often as researchers, and I think this is true for any number of people who are trying to get a sense of the pulse of the country as a whole, whether from a political standpoint, whether from a marketing, figuring out, really what are the trends in this, what are the trends, what the trends are both politically and commercially, perhaps. I think they could use this information to figure out what are the test markets for different products, and they may end up coming here quite a bit. You may end up seeing, if a political reporter or two has read this study, they may come by and be interviewing some folks in your area.
Trying to find the average people in the most average places.
You're trying to, and again, because everybody's trying to do these sort of anecdotal, on the ground reporting. We're all trying to, everybody seems to be trying to do that. And in politics, in the media, and, you know, the people who are sort of interested in sort of understanding.
Right. They're finding Joe the plumber.
I think we're trying to give them a sense of, you know, in one way of doing it. I mean, number one, we're just fascinated by this idea, you know, of what is the place that sort of represents the country as a whole, even if there wasn't like an action, you know, in exactly like.
But this points at a huge existential crisis that basically we're all like, who are we?
Exactly. Right. So, and, you know, and oftentimes, again, we're defined by the extremes, but there's not as much emphasis on where we are as a country as a whole.
Patrick Ruffini of Echelon Insights, thanks so much.
Thank you.
You can find the whole list his firm compiled of the most typical counties in America online. We'll link to it with the audio from this discussion. Up next, local history block by block. Is the block you live on a meaningful part of who you are and how you live? Call and tell us why. 816-235-2888. I'm Gina Kaufman. We are back. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard. And now I'm joined by Mary Jo Draper, who writes a neighborhood news and history blog called The Midtown Post. She's been working on a project for the last few years looking at Kansas City history block by block. A recent post on a particular block of Jefferson Street, the block between 34th and 35th, really intrigued me. She titled that post, A Block of Immigrants. Mary Jo, good morning.
Good morning. It's great to be here.
So start by describing what you uncovered about the block of immigrants I just referenced, 34th and 35th Street and Jefferson.
Well, as I guess maybe it should not be so surprising because of when the block was built, around 1910, but we began to see as Kansas City was being built up and the neighborhoods that are now part of Midtown were being built up in around 1910, which was when most of them were built, there was also this huge influx of immigrants coming here. And so on this particular block of Valentine, we saw people from Russia, from Ireland, from Denmark, from Sweden, from Germany.
And they're the ones originally building this block, building the homes and stuff?
They and that's something that I have learned from doing this kind of project. I guess I used to believe that people like built their own homes. People came and said, I think I'll build a house here. But it was more like there were developers that were building sometimes a whole block, but sometimes they would just build one house or two houses on a block, and they would either sell them or rent them to people.
This makes sense now that you're pointing that out, that like in olden times it worked like it does now. Basically, someone builds a house recognizing that someone will want to move there.
I think it works. It works two ways. As Midtown was developing, the more wealthy people would hire an architect and find a really great piece of land and build their house there. But the people that weren't so wealthy were the ones, and the new immigrants were probably maybe not in a position to be buying a house, so they would maybe be renting these new houses that were being built for them.
Okay, so take me back. Sorry to get off track. This block on Jefferson Street.
So you just had all these people, all these households kind of living there together in homes and apartments. There were 24 houses on the block. 15 of them were headed by recent immigrants. And I just think that's fascinating to think about, all those people sort of living in one block, next door to each other, interacting with each other, and you know, how interesting it must have been.
What led you to start researching local history this way?
Well, basically, the Midtown KC Post, when it first began, was a blog that covered both what's going on today in Midtown Kansas City and the history of, and it sort of evolved into also covering the history. And I called it the Uncovering History Project because it seemed like you needed some grounding in the history to really understand what's going on today. And then the for a number of reasons, the covering what's going on today part of the Midtown Casey Post didn't work out quite as well as I had hoped. But the uncovering history part seemed to be popular with people. And so I continued to do it. And part of it was that when I was first, I'm really fascinated with Midtown. I'm really sort of in love with Midtown. And the neighborhoods of Midtown have always been really fascinating to me. And I wanted to understand how they started. And I wrote a book about the history of the Midtown neighborhoods, but I really didn't get a chance to really delve into each neighborhood. And so it seemed like going block by block, it's almost what you have to do to really understand how things got started.
So how do you do the research?
Well, it's a little bit tedious unless you're a little bit anal like I think I am. I basically start with there are three really great sources of information at the Kansas City Public Library. And one of those is a series of photos that were taken in the 1940s during the WPA, which was after the Depression. And they actually hired somebody to go out and take a picture of every house in Jackson County, every building in Jackson County. And so there's a whole set of photos, and they're on at the Kansas City Public Library, and they're online. So you can go and look at them. You can look up your house. You have to figure out what block it's on and which one it is in the pictures of those blocks. And then there's also a set of maps called the Sanborn Maps. And the Sanborn Maps were devised by a fire insurance company. So they needed to know which houses were, which buildings were brick and which buildings were frame and where the risk of fire was higher. And so they drew these really intricate maps of every single block where you can see what was there when those maps were drawn. And there are different sets of those that are available also at the library. And then I go back through old newspaper. So I start with those. Then I go back through old newspaper clippings and I look up every address on the block and I see what happened at this address. And sometimes there'll be a famous person that lived there and there'll be a lot of information. More often, what's really interesting is that a lot of times you learn a lot about who lived there because they were involved in some kind of a crime.
Which is like exactly, if you were like the resident, the owner of that home or a resident of that home, that might be exactly the kind of thing you don't want to know.
Yeah, but that's what gets recorded in history.
So the metric of a block is super interesting to me. There's national history or even regional history or city history, which is all of those things are very collective, shared history kinds of things. Then if you look at something like a memoir that will tell the story of a specific person through their own eyes and it's history at this individual level, it's very personal. A block to me feels almost like something in between because it is so personal that you're looking at like just a handful of homes and the sort of, you know, what you see when you step out your front door. Mm-hmm. But it is shared to some degree. It's really interesting as a unit of measure to me.
And it's interesting, you know, when people respond, and that's a big part of this project is getting people to respond I feel like what I find is the tip of the iceberg, and I'm hoping that it starts a conversation for the people that lived on that block, and then they'll write in on the comments on the stories, and they'll say, I remember this family. And think about it. That's how you remember where you grew up. You remember your own house, but you also remember your block and the people that live next door and who the kids that you played with. So it's kind of a normal way to think about the history of
a place
that you remember, that any place.
Well, if your sense of identity, your sense of place in Kansas City has something to do with the block you live on, not just the neighborhood or the county or the subdivision, but the block itself, call 816-235-2888 to tell us about it. We'll hear about some more of the blocks Mary Jo Draper has researched for us in the Midtown KC Post, but we want to hear about your block, 816-235-2888. Mary Jo, I'm curious whether the block that you live on now or a block you have lived on really means something particular to you and gives you a lens into a piece of what it means to be from Kansas City that might look different just a couple blocks beyond that.
Well, it does. And I think I live in the Valentine neighborhood, and I've lived there for 35 years. And when we talk, I was just at a book club meeting the other night of people in the neighborhood. And we, of course, you know, divide ourselves within the neighborhood. You know, when we're outside the neighborhood, we talk about being from Valentine. When we're inside the neighborhood, we talk about being from Jefferson Street or Pennsylvania Street or this particular block. And you do have, you do feel like you have more in common with the people that live right on your block.
So which one are you?
I'm on Pennsylvania.
So what's the Pennsylvania, like, deal?
The Pennsylvania is a really great block. And but, I mean, the houses have an interesting history. The houses were mostly built in 1910. Of course, one of the unique things about our particular block and all of Valentine is that it used to be a racetrack. So people find that history really interesting. And the writer's place used to be on our block. They've just recently moved out, but it's kind of a unique place.
You've also looked into a block of Westport Road and about 48th Street in the West Plaza neighborhood. Uh-huh. Tell me about that block.
So I love the West Plaza neighborhood. And one of the things that I learned in starting to do this project was when I first started out, it seemed like most of the history we know about Midtown Kansas City is about Hyde Park. We know that these really rich people built houses on Janssen Place, and they built up Hyde Park, and we know the history of those houses. We don't know a lot about a neighborhood like the West Plaza, which was built as a working-class neighborhood. It was built when the homes that were built there were often just like three-room homes. There would be a living room, a kitchen, and a bedroom. The stove would serve both for cooking and for heating the house. And so they were built on much smaller lots, which tells you that they were built for not the richest people in town. And so now, because of that history, because those houses were built for working class people, they're smaller. They've tended to be more affordable. And it's created a community over there where you have a lot of musicians, a lot of artists. People may remember that the original Porch Fest was held in that neighborhood, and a lot of people got introduced to it then. So it makes it very unique from some of the other neighborhoods.
Let's talk to Jennifer in Lenexa. Hi, Jennifer.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call, and thank you for the work you're doing. It sparks some interest for me. My mom recently, she's 78 and came to Kansas City in 1965, a master's degree in chemistry, and lived in a home in the Hyde Park area. I can't say exactly where it was, but it was living with a bunch of other single women. Apparently, this was not unusual for the homes there had been divided up. Last year, that home had been restored, and it was on the tour of homes. And so she, along with a couple of the other women who she lived with her first year in Kansas City, went back to see the old house that she had lived in. And I think the floor that she lived in was a like the ballroom, or wow, would have been the old ballroom area. And so it was kind of nostalgic to go back and see it restored to that.
Yeah. Well, Jennifer, let's get our guest's response to this. Mary Jo Draper?
Well, I think that's really typical. And it's, you know, a lot of people have lived in Midtown. If they don't live here now, they lived here when they were in college. Maybe they lived here after college. And so lots and lots of people have memories of Midtown. And Jennifer, did your mother have any pictures or any relics of her time here?
You know, she probably does have pictures from back there, back when she lived in that apartment or lived with her girlfriend.
See, that's part of my dream about this project, was that there were hundreds of people sitting out there with shoebox fulls of of photographs that would come flooding in as soon as I opened up the floodgates.
Do they?
Unfortunately, if they do, they haven't come flooding in. But I still, every now and then, people have more memories. It seems that people didn't take as many pictures.
And they aren't just conveniently sitting on their computer already.
Yeah.
Like there in digital form. Let's talk to Robert in Brookside. Hi, Robert.
Good morning.
What do you want to share? What block are you telling us about?
The 5900 block of McGee Street in Brookside. This particular part of Brookside is known as Morningside Park. And the homes were built between 70 and 100 years ago. And ironically, as everybody knows, redlining was truly a practice way back then. And Morningside Park was the first residential district in Kansas City where Jewish families could own homes. That's the historic perspective. Our particular block, my wife and I have lived in our home for 38 years. It's the only home we've ever owned, and we've basically rebuilt that. That's true of many people in our neighborhood, and you see a continued group of people who are upgrading and doing wonderful things to their homes that are still preserving the historical nature of the structure, but adding new accoutrements, of course, that make it more updated.
Do you
think the age spectrum runs from 20 to 90?
That's great. That's great.
Well, so Mary Jo, I know that this might not be within the parameters of the part of town you tend to look at, but when you see a block like that where people have held on to homes for 38 years, as Robert just told us, his family has been in this home for 38 years and plans to stay, and that's typical on his block, which is not the narrative you kind of hear right now in
Brookside.
Yeah, I
think that is kind of unusual, and I think that's great. I wish that would happen more. Robert, do you know, is the block you live in, is the area you live in, was it a Nichols development?
I believe it was, yes. Diebold also developed part of that a little bit later. But yes, I believe it was originally platted by J.C. Nichols.
Why do you think people have stayed there so long?
Well, it wasn't designed with the same parameters that neighborhoods are now, which is to say you'll find homes that are quite, maybe $500,000 to $800,000 in cost built around the corner from or perhaps right next to homes that would cost $200,000 to $300,000. So it wasn't engineered trying to attract people with the same economic capabilities. And that's frankly, an education all of itself. Mm-hmm. We stayed there. Even though the public schools weren't the greatest, we stayed there because it was an education for our daughters. They learned that not everybody could afford or needed three cars. Some people couldn't afford to fix the air conditioning in the summertime. You know, it's important to live next to people and with people, be a part of the fabric with people that aren't exactly like you.
Yeah, that's great. And that is a big reason that people traditionally moved in and out a lot of the neighborhoods of Kansas City has to do with the school district and the history of the school district. So people that had been in blocks and had been here for a long time at one point began to leave because of the school district. And now they're coming back, and that's great to see.
Let's hear about George calling us from Southmoreland, that neighborhood. But he is talking to us about a block on Warwick, which I know, Mary Jo, you have highlighted Warwick as a particularly interesting street as well. So let's talk about Warwick now, starting with George. Hi, George.
Hi. Good morning. Thank you. I bought my house in 1975. It was built in 1898, according to the water records. I guess that's how you determine the age of your house.
What block are we talking about, George?
It's 41st to 43rd in Warwick.
Okay, go on.
And what's interesting, when I bought the house, the owners gave me the original abstract that date back to the 1800s with all the original signatures, et cetera. And I researched one of the owners in 1900 was he lived there for 25 years and actually died in the house, apparently. He was the first homeopathic doctor in Kansas City.
Interesting.
And actually ran his clinic apparently out of the house.
You know, George,
at that time.
I'm going to have you hang on here because what's interesting to me about George's call is that it's so easy to get caught up in the famous person who once lived there. But that's actually like not what you're doing.
Yeah. Well, you know, it seems to me like history is sort of self-perpetuating. So as I said earlier, it seemed to me when I first started out, we knew a lot about the history of Hyde Park. And then every time you'd see a new book or article or something about the history of Kansas City, it was sort of regurgitating the history that we already knew. And not really – and I was afraid that we're going to lose that other history. And to me, some of the history that's most interesting is the history of those working-class neighborhoods or those more middle-class neighborhoods that weren't necessarily the houses that were built for the most wealthy people. Although I have to say I am really fascinated by Warwick Boulevard because I think it was an extremely important street in terms of the structures that were built there, the houses that were built there, because of the proximity to William Rockhill Nelson's home, which is where the Nelson is now.
There is a distinctive architectural style, and I can picture the part of Warwick that George is describing. It's kind of like lots of turrets and wraparound balconies, and
it's a little bit older than a lot of the neighborhoods in Kansas City. Like he said, it was built before 1900, and a lot of the homes in Midtown were built after 1900, more like 1910. So it's older, and just the architecture is interesting there.
What do you learn about Kansas City looking at it block by block, like looking at trying to understand the personality of Warwick and why it is what it is today, going all the way back to when people first started living there?
Well, what you'd learn about Warwick is that, as I mentioned, William Rockhill Nelson built his house where the Nelson Atkins Museum is now. And he was out in the country. That was a farm when he first moved out there. And then August Meyer built Vanderslice Hall, which is now the big, beautiful building at the Art Institute. And they were out in the country. And once they were there, it signaled, and August Meyer was the first head of the Parks Department in Kansas City. It signaled to other wealthy people, I guess it's okay to move that direction. It's okay to move south. People had been moving to the east, had been moving to the northeast, but now it was okay to start moving south. And so Warwick was a major street. So they started to build their bigger houses along Warwick. You know, it was still a dirt road. And there was a really fascinating guy that lived along Warwick whose name was Lyle Goodman, who was a really famous guy. He knew an expert on orchards. And he had a huge orchard that stretched across Warwick, an apple orchard. And people used to take the streetcar down to his property to pick the apple blossoms when they bloomed in the spring.
So going block by block just sort of helps you understand how things changed and why.
I just discovered Lyle Goodman doing that, yeah.
Wow. Well, our time is up for today's show, but Mary Jo Draper with us from the Midtown KC Post, thank you so much.
It was great to be here.
Tomorrow, we will be talking about food. It is our food show here on KCUR's Central Standard. We will be talking about soups and stews, and we will take you behind the scenes looking at how a special meatball soup gets made at a local Mexican restaurant. Plus, looking back on 2018 in restaurants, openings, closings, new chefs, expansions, that kind of thing. We'll have it all tomorrow at 10. Tune in. Don't miss it. You can talk to us anytime on Twitter. We are at KCURCST, and we'd love to hear your ideas, and we'd still love to hear about your block. So you can tweet us a picture of your block and what it says about you, what it determines about how you live your life here. We are at KCURCST. This show is produced by Melody Rowell with Coy Duggar, Suzanne Hogan, Chris Young, and intern Salisa Kalakal. Sylvia Maria Gross is our senior producer. I'm Gina Kaufman. Up to Date is next.